Now, shall we begin?
Around the dinner table, when you begin to carp and criticize those people, school principals, teachers, policemen, pastors, parents, presidents, whatever you do, do you know what you're building in your children? A spirit of rebellion. Spirit of rebellion. Why will not this person submit to authority?
Being disrespectful at any age to anyone now could get you killed.
For mother of three, Chiquita Hill, calling the police to her Columbus home to teach her son a lesson.
Liberty, but I want to reaffirm, I want him to take his liberty and just preach to us. He was upset because he preached an hour and 10 minutes, and we were upset he didn't go longer. It seemed like
okay with everything. Then they entered the house, talked to Sean about his behavior, put cuffs on him, and then sat him in the back of a squad car for about 5 minutes. Hill posted photos of the experience to her Facebook page, and she's received more than 1,000 shares and hundreds of comments. I had black cops arrest me when I was 15, and I love them for it. I wouldn't be who I am today.
There is an unsavory epithet beginning with the letter F that is very commonplace in political debates, particularly in social media. This word is flung heedlessly in the heat of debate for the purpose of inflicting a verbal injury rather than illuminating a dispute. And it's used by people who don't fully understand either its origins or its substance. That F word is fascist or fascism. This has been the preferred term of rhetorical abuse since World War II or shortly before that conflict, for obvious reasons, although between the late 20s and about 1940, Benito Mussolini, who originated the doctrine of fascism, was really held in high regard by the type of people who define our political fashions. He was considered, I think appropriately, either a successor to Woodrow Wilson as the head of the progressive movement, or as sort of a forerunner of FDR and his New Deal. And both of those descriptions are accurate, because both Woodrow Wilson's government and the regime of FDR were dealing with the same concepts that Benito Mussolini would later impose upon Italy. I think a case could be made that Mussolini drew upon certain elements of what Wilson had done and certain elements of what had happened in the United States in the name of manifest destiny, for that matter, and then he refined them, and then they were imported back into the United States through the administration of FDR. As a matter of fact, there's very good documentation by Charlotte Twight and other academics that the FDR Brain Trust actually dined very robustly on the writings of Giovanni Gentile, who was one of Mussolini's chief theoreticians. To understand what fascism truly means, obviously, we have to go back to the founding documents of that movement. And one very good source is the 1932 manifesto entitled The Doctrine of Fascism, which was co-written by Benito Mussolini, who took chief credit as the author, obviously, and Giovanni Gentile, for the purpose, no doubt, of taking Mussolini's somewhat amorphous thoughts and rendering them into somewhat readable prose. About two-thirds of the way through that essay, and it's only about 20 pages long, you can find a really concise definition of what fascism means. The keystone of the fascist doctrine is its conception of the state, of its essence, its functions, and its aims. For fascism, the state is absolute, individuals and groups relative. Individuals and groups are admissible insofar as they come within the state. Instead of directing the game and guiding the material and moral progress of the community, the liberal state, liberal in this instance referring to a state that is not centrally directed, a state that would be constructed along Lockean lines rather than fascist lines. Instead of directing the game and guiding the material and moral progress of the community, the liberal state restricts its activities to recording results. The fascist state is wide awake and has a will of its own. For this reason, it can be described as ethical. I don't know how he makes that logical jump, but then again, I'm not an adherent of his cult. To continue. At the first quinquennial assembly of the regime in 1929, I said, the fascist state is not a night watchman, solicitous only of the personal safety of its citizens, nor is it organized exclusively for the purpose of guaranteeing a certain degree of material prosperity and relatively peaceful conditions of life. A board of directors would do as much. Neither is it exclusively political, divorced from practical realities and holding itself aloof from the multifarious activities of the citizens and the nation. The state, as conceived and realized by fascism, is a spiritual and ethical entity for securing the political, juridical, and economic organization of the nation, an organization which in its origin and growth is a manifestation of the spirit. The state guarantees the internal and external safety of the country, but it also safeguards and transmits the spirit of the people, elaborated down the ages in its language, its customs, its faith. The state is not only the present, it is also the past, and above all, the future. Transcending the individual's brief spell of life, the state stands for the immanent conscience of the nation. The forms in which it finds expression change, but the need for it remains. The state educates the citizens to civism, makes them aware of their mission, urges them to unity. Its justice harmonizes their divergent interests. It transmits to future generations the conquests of the mind in the fields of science, art, law, human solidarity. It leads men up from primitive tribal life to that highest manifestation of human power, imperial rule. The state, he continues, hands down to future generations the memory of those who laid down their lives to ensure its safety. Note carefully, he's referring to the safety of the state. On November 11th, of course, the United States will experience the annual orgy of militaristic devotion called Veterans Day. It used to be called Armistice Day. It used to celebrate the ending of a war, and now it celebrates permanent mobilization for war. Once again, as Mussolini said, the state hands down to future generations the memory of those who laid down their lives to ensure its safety or to obey its laws. It sets up as examples and records for future ages the names of the captains who enlarged its territory and of the men of genius who have made it famous. Notice how at every point here, the measure of greatness is what people have done in the name of the state or in order to advance its claims. Not accomplishments within the realm of peaceful commerce or exploration or scientific progress that have applications in private life. The private life has nothing at all to do with this. The state is the cynosure of the society, and the way that people distinguish themselves is by helping to aggrandize the state. Whenever respect for the state declines and the disintegrating and centrifugal tendencies of individuals and groups prevail, nations are headed for decay. That's a theme we are hearing incessantly being chanted at us by authoritarian conservatives who were talking about the supposed crisis of a rising tide of disrespect for the law and for the people to embody it, our gallant defenders of the public weal, the costumed enforcers of state orthodoxy and authority. That's language right out of Mussolini's lexicon. If liberalism spells individualism, fascism spells government. He continues, fascism desires the state to be strong and organic, based on broad foundations of popular support. The fascist state lays claim to rule in the economic field no less than in others. It makes its action felt through the length and breadth of the country by means of its corporative, social, and educational institutions and all the political, economic, and spiritual forces of the nation organized in their respective associations circulate within the state. A state based on millions of individuals who recognize its authority, feel its action, and are ready to serve its ends is not the tyrannical state of the medieval lordling. It has nothing in common with the despotic states existing prior to or subsequent to 1789. Far from crushing the individual, the fascist state multiplies his energies. The fascist state organizes the nation, but it leaves the individual adequate elbow room. It has curtailed useless or harmful liberties while preserving those which are essential. In such matters, the individual cannot be the judge, but the state only. Which liberties, one might ask, are essential, and which ones are disposable? That question doesn't necessarily concern the fascist, whose views are defined by a rigid authoritarian positivism. The only thing that really matters, according to Mussolini and other people who knowingly or unconsciously adhere to his doctrine, The only thing that really matters is the deference the individual owes to the state as embodied by those who exercise its authority. When I come back, I will elaborate on that theme with appropriate examples. This is Will Grigg with Freedom Zealot Radio. Stand by for more Sedition after this.
Now, Glenn, your take on it.
Yeah, I mean, Megan, you are far too lovely to even speculate at your age, and you're far younger than I am. But in my day, as an old man now, if I would have come home and there was a video of me sitting in that chair, my parents would have said to me, what the hell were you even saying that brought that cop? Why did somebody have to call a police officer in the first place on you? And my parents wouldn't have listened to my plea. They would have watched this and said, then, first of all, they were called into the classroom because of you. Second of all, he said to you, get up, come with me. You obey the police officer, period. No ifs, ands, or buts. This is an absolute ticket to anarchy, which is exactly what many in our country would like.
We direct the fashionable outcry of each generation against those vices of which it is least in danger, and fix its approval on the virtue nearest to that vice which we are trying to make endemic. The game is to have them running about with fire extinguishers whenever there is a flood, and all crowding to that side of the boat which is already nearly gunwale under. Cruel ages are put on their guard against sentimentality, feckless and idle ones against respectability, lecherous ones against Puritanism, and whenever all men are really hastening to be slaves or tyrants, we make liberalism the prime bogey, explained veteran demon Screwtape, who was counseling an apprentice devil named Wormwood in C.S. Lewis's immortal allegory, The Screwtape Letters, to be specific, Letter 25. Welcome back to Freedom Zealot Radio. I'm William Grigg. In addition to producing this broadcast, I am the author and proprietor of the Pro Libertate blog, which can be found at freedominourtime.blogspot.com. There's a PayPal button at the bottom of every essay. There's another one at the right-hand margin of the page, along with a Bitcoin button. I would really appreciate any help that you would care to provide. C.S. Lewis was making reference to liberalism as the philosophy of individual liberty, which is to say that the highest political good is the freedom of the individual to develop the talents that he or she possesses in mutually beneficial private enterprise, cooperative, commercial ventures, artistic ventures, fellowship, faith, family, all the things that have nothing to do with this artifice of coercion and corruption that we call the state. He was pointing out, even then, this was decades ago, he died in 1963, the year I was born, even decades ago, even in the post-war West, or perhaps especially in the post-war West, men were hastening to become slaves to tyrants, in that we were being warned even then by supposed conservatives that the real enemy was small L liberalism, not the partisan variety that is associated with the Democratic Party, but rather the preoccupation with individual liberty rather than the collective as administered by the state. In a very real sense, therefore, you could say that C.S. Lewis was the anti-Mussolini. This is what Mussolini had to say about how society should be organized from the fascist perspective. Anti-individualistic, the fascist conception of life stresses the importance of the state and accepts the individual only insofar as his interests coincide with those of the state, which stands for the conscience and the universal will of man as a historic entity. Liberalism denied the state in the name of the individual. Fascism asserts the rights of the state in expressing the real essence of the individual. Fascism stands for liberty and for the only liberty worth having, the liberty of the state and of the individual within the state. Fascism, in short, continues Mussolini, is not only the giver of laws and the founder of institutions, but the educator and promoter of spiritual life. It wants to remake not the forms of human life, but its content, man, character, faith. And to this end, it requires discipline and authority that can enter into the spirits of men and there govern unopposed. Its sign, therefore, is the lictor's rods, the symbol of unity, of strength, and of justice. The lictors, we're not really sure where the institution originated. Presumably it originated with the Etruscans, the pre-Roman inhabitants of what would later become Rome. The lictors in Republican, post-Republican Rome and Imperial Rome were essentially police officers. They're most famously associated with the magistrate as a bodyguard, although there were various ranks of lictors or official bodyguards who were assigned to other ceremonial offices and other institutions within Roman society. Among their tasks was to act as what we would now call a bailiff, standing next to the magistrate when he addressed a crowd. And that explains why the speaker's platform in the Roman Forum, or the rostra, that's where the word rostrum comes from, was so large. The council had to stand there, but he had to be flanked by his entire escort, which included the lictors. Lictors were also involved in minor jobs like opening gates and knocking on doors, explains one historical account. The lictor was also responsible for the safety of the magistrate when he was at home. We read about visits to temples, theaters, and even baths. The most important role they carried out is they were responsible for arresting and punishing people. This was the function implied in the fascus. The fascus is the familiar symbol of a bundle of rods that support an axe. You can actually see that on the obverse of the Mercury dime. You can still see the fascus, interestingly enough, in the House of Representatives. And at that obscene pagan temple dedicated to Abraham the Destroyer, the throne upon which the Destroyer sits contains the symbol I'm referring to here, that of the fascus. That predates, obviously, the emergence of fascism, as did the Mercury dime, as did the decorations of the well of the House of Representatives. The fascus were a bundle of rods from which an axe protruded. The rods could be used to scourge people, and the axe to execute them. Probably, according to this historical commentary, this last task, that of execution, had already become a dead letter by the middle of the 5th century, after the laws of the 12 tables, that would be the equivalent of the Constitution of Rome, no Roman magistrate could summarily execute a Roman citizen. Interestingly enough, no police official, whether you're talking about a lictor, or you're talking about a centurion, or somebody else who would be given responsibility to supervise people in the same sense that a modern police officer would, no police official in Imperial Rome could handcuff, could bind a citizen until the citizen had been convicted of a crime. That's something we read about actually in the book of Acts as it happens. Because as Paul, having been arrested for the equivalent of disturbing the peace or disorderly conduct, was about to be scourged, he asked the centurion in charge of the detail what the charge was and when he had been convicted of a crime, because he was a Roman citizen and it was against the law for a Roman official to punish a Roman citizen or even to bind him unless he had been convicted of a crime. And the punishment for this was that the Roman official would have to endure the same punishment that he would be meting out without the benefit of law upon a Roman citizen. That stands in sharp contrast to the discretionary power given to modern police officers in the United States to handcuff citizens who are not charged with a crime or suspected of a crime simply for the safety of the police officer. The police officers in form and function, in other words, are a great deal like the lictors in ancient Rome and the symbol invoked by Mussolini to embody his notion of what he called the totalitarian state. But in terms of the powers that they exercise, contemporary police officers in America have far greater latitude in inflicting punishment upon people not suspected of a crime, let alone convicted of a crime. Subjects of Mussolini's totalitarian fascist order were required to pay respect to the symbol of unity, strength, and justice, the lictor's rod, or the fascus. That's broadly comparable to admonitions Americans routinely receive to respect the badge. I'll be back in just a minute.
When you talk about privilege, I had a father that would have done worse to me than that policeman did. If I'd have come home, or if he'd have seen a video of me, you know, disrespecting an officer, or much less a principal, and then the teacher.
So you're saying you were Benjamin, you were an abused child?
You've seen this by now. The officer caught on tape body slamming a female student refusing to leave class. He was fired for excessive use of force, but wait a second. There's something no one's talking about here. Before the teacher called for the officer, the student defied the teacher, and no one raised an eyebrow. Now, Jessica, this is not about justifying what the cop did. This is about why more kids don't seem to respect authority figures like teachers and cops. I mean, look, kids respected parents, they respected teachers, they respected coaches. That seems to be out the window. Right, right. And John, I teach my son, he's 17 years old, and I've taught him since he was a baby. You respect the cop. I don't care what happens. You think the cop is wrong, you think you're being unjustly talked to or searched or whatever, you respect that man or woman.
Exactly.
And
right.
That's not seeming to be the culture now, though.
That's it, Eric. I mean, Jessica says, well, the cop should have cleared the room and talked with the student. Like, a cop is force. That's the police. That's what the law is. So if you don't obey the police, you should expect that force will be used against you. And, Eric, there's a tremendous breakdown in our society. I happen to think a lot of it started with the rise of the progressive movement, the modern progressive movement in the 1960s. All these things like food stamps, welfare, mandatory drug laws, affirmative action, of course, the terrible public schools. That is what contributes to, I think, the home environment, if you will, that Jessica's
alluding to. The punishment part of it is what is missing, in my opinion. I could be wrong. I'm probably going to get yelled at about for saying this.
Fascism stands for liberty, and for the only liberty worth having, the liberty of the state and of the individual within the state, explained Benito Mussolini in 1932. 62 years later, a somewhat different ethnic Italian tyrant said essentially the same thing. Freedom is about authority. Freedom is about the willingness of every single human being to cede to lawful authority a great deal of discretion about what you do. Thus proclaimed Mayor Rudolph Giuliani in 1994 in a speech devoted to law enforcement. Mayor Rudolph W. Giuliani was among the speakers on Wednesday at a forum about crime in the cities sponsored by the New York Post, reported the New York Times. Here is an excerpt as transcribed by the New York Times. We constantly present the false impression that government can solve problems that government America was designed not to solve. Families are significantly less important in the development of children today than they were 30 or 40 years ago. That much, I will concede, is incontestable. Religion has less influence than it did 30 or 40 years ago. I disagree with that assessment. What has happened is that religion has become deracinated. It has become a consumer product rather than a faith commitment, and a lot of the content being preached in the name of religion is actually state-focused rather than God-focused. That's one of the major problems with our society, as a matter of fact. Communities, continued Rudolph Giuliani, don't mean what they meant 30 or 40 years ago. That's not necessarily a bad thing. During the frontier period, there was a blessed interval before Manifest Destiny really gathered steam, where there were many places in the what would become the continental United States where an anarchic legal order existed that was focused on property rather than the claims of community. You had communities coalesce out of shared enterprises. That's what a wagon train would be, for instance. They were not organized around claims of authority. They were organized around property rights and an understanding of mutual respect for the
keepers.
Owns. if you have a legitimate claim to possess something, you have authority over it. That includes, of course, duties or considerations spelled out in a contract or a covenant. You have authority over the performance of somebody with whom you have entered into a contract. Being to cede to lawful authority a great deal of discretion about what you do. This really is somebody who is naturally suited to be bellowing from a balcony, isn't it? At the core, the struggle is philosophical, he continued. There are many, many things that can be done in law enforcement.
Vinny would have a bakery with his wife.
I have tried
Why
to talk
her. Why the hell have you guys not done that?
I try to tell her for all the time she spends baking, all the money she spends baking, there should be some kind of income out of this.
Why doesn't she start a bakery?
I don't know.
Why doesn't she...
authority, very much cognate with what Mussolini was preaching in the 1930s. Earlier this year, and I have adverted to this conversation in previous broadcasts, Giuliani, who was a fixture on Fox News, had a lengthy discussion with Bill O'Reilly. This is what Giuliani had to say in terms of the fundamental tenet of his worldview. The president of the United States should say to all children, here's the rule, kids, when the cop tells you to go, you go. You say, yes, sir, no, sir, yes, police officer, no, police officer. You don't disrespect a police officer. He's a symbol of authority. The besetting problem in modern American society, we are constantly told by police unions, by the likes of Fox News, is not widespread abuse and other misconduct by law enforcement officers or other people in authority, but increasing disrespect for authority that is being abetted by who else? Liberals, and by the even more disreputable folks called libertarians. Young people are disrespecting authority, O'Reilly groused during the segment, pandering to the prejudices of his superannuated and rather incurious audience. He insisted that young people in America, especially teenagers, have a defiance toward authority not seen since the Vietnam days. And so pronounced has this social affliction become, according to Dr. O'Reilly's diagnosis, that the entire population under the age of 25 should be written off as a lost generation. That's a proposal he made with blithe indifference to an audience that's roughly three times that age. Most of the people who actually watch Bill O'Reilly are septuagenarians. If you were around in the late 1960s and early 1970s, you know that history is repeating itself, O'Reilly continued. Young people at that time, of course, were subject to enslavement through conscription, and they grew understandably distrustful of government. Now, Mr. O'Reilly is a stranger in the House of Reason, so he laments that this healthy distrust of conscription and of the unnecessary illegal war in Vietnam led to a breakdown of authority and the rise of the sex, drugs, and rock and roll era. This, of course, is another familiar theme that was woven not only into Italian fascism, but also into National Socialism. Both Mussolini and Hitler inveighed against the decadent, dissolute cultures that had taken root in their respective countries. They lamented the rise of an effete culture without discipline. They talked about the need, and this is something I mentioned a couple of weeks ago with respect to conscription and the William James essay that was of such seminal influence on the thinking of, among other people, Mussolini, the need for the moral equivalent of war in order to knock the lack of discipline and immaturity out of young people. These are people who needed the stern hand of authority. That stern hand would conduct them in the direction that the state would ordain. The most significant problem in American culture is not a disrespect for authority. It's a lack of understanding of the principle of private property and a lack of respect for the sanctity thereof. I'll be back in just a minute.
It seems as though there's no respect for authority.
Respect for authority, and that's what it's all about, Michelle. Jessica, can there be respect for authority if there's no punishment? I mean, it's an equation, right? It's an equation. Without any punishment, how can you get respect? Authority, and force won't even be an issue.
And let me just say, when Jessica sets it up like this, child is walking down the street and all of a sudden a policeman comes up and throws him again. Yes, when you do not respect authority, when you don't listen to the police, you should expect that force will be used against you. You know, is this excessive? Is this not excessive? That's a discussion for another time.
The preponderant conservative reaction to the incident at the South Carolina high school about a week ago could be summarized in the vulgar phrase, "Taste the authority, bitch." The idea is that punishment has to have a central role in organizing society in deference to authority. And authority, of course, is this mystical property that gives state functionaries the supposed right to initiate force against people who have done no injury to anybody else. In a property-focused society, the only authority that people would exercise would be over that which they legitimately own, and the only legitimate force would be defensive in nature to protect the person and property of every individual. In a fascist society, which is what we unambiguously are, albeit of a different sort than what prevailed in Mussolini's Italy. In a fascist society, punishment or the threat thereof is ubiquitous in order to compel people to submit to the demands of state authority. Paul Craig Roberts, the erratic but frequently brilliant former Treasury official from the Reagan administration, has pointed out in a recent essay that punishment has become a primary feature of American, indeed Western, society. Interestingly enough, as he points out, this fascistic disposition to punish people is not confined to one end of the spectrum. A baker in Colorado was punished because he would not bake a wedding cake for a homosexual marriage. A county or state clerk was punished because she would not issue a marriage license for a homosexual marriage. University professors are punished because they criticize Israel's inhumane treatment of Palestinians. Whistleblowers are punished, despite the protection under federal law, for revealing crimes of the U.S. government, and children are punished for being children, but not by their parents. This, by the way, is a very interesting element of what Dr. Roberts is discussing. The role of parents is not to exercise authority within the home, but rather to cultivate deference to state authority. Police can slam children around and seriously injure them, but parents must not lay a hand on a child. If a child gets spanked, as everyone in my generation was, and that's something, by the way, to which I object, in comes the Child Protective Services Gestapo. The child is seized, put into protective custody, and the parents are arrested. The CPS Gestapo receives a federal bonus for every child that they seize, and they want the money. About all parents can do today is restrict TV or video game playing time. Even this is dicey, because the kids are taught at school to report abusive behavior of parents. For many kids, being told what to do by parents is abusive behavior. Kids have learned that they can pay back parents for disciplining them by reporting the parents to teachers or by themselves calling CPS. In Mussolini's fascist dictionary, the entry for the word family read in its entirety, "See fascist state." The idea was that the state had a proprietary claim on all children. That very much is a vivid and active principle in today's American society under the rubric of parens patriae. Kids who retaliate in this socially approved manner do not realize that they run a high risk of ruining the lives of their parents as well as their own and ending up in foster care where the risk of sexual abuse is present. As society has made it possible for kids to prevail over parents, the kids think this right also applies to teachers, school administrators, and school resource officers, psychopaths with police badges who maintain discipline with force and violence. The kids quickly discover, as Shakara discovered in a recent encounter with Ben Fields, apparently Shakara is the name of the young woman, that whereas parents are constrained from using corporal punishment, school resource officers are not. Shakara's desk was overturned as she sat in it. She was slammed onto the floor, dragged across the floor and handcuffed. Any parent who did that would be facing jail time. Schools are no longer places of learning. They are places of punishment. Kids are punished for the most absurd reasons. nothing more than behaving as a child brings on punishment. As Henry Giroux has written, schools have become places of control, repression, and punishment. 17,000 American public schools have a police presence. All common sense is long departed. 5- and 6-year-olds who get into a shoving match are arrested and carried off in handcuffs. Police issue tickets and fines to students for what was ordinary behavior in my school days. Suspensions result, as do police records that hamper a child's prospect of success. The violence that Ben Fields used against Shikari is routine. Mother Jones reports that a Louisville goon thug, Jonathan Harden, punched a 13-year-old in the face for cutting into the cafeteria line. The same officer held another 13-year-old in a chokehold until the student became unconscious. A dispute over cell phone use resulted in a Houston student being hit 18 times with a police weapon. The police violence extends beyond the schools. Any American unfortunate enough to have a police encounter risks being tasered, beaten, arrested, or even murdered. Protesters, war and otherwise, are beaten, tear-gassed, arrested. The American police state is working hard to criminalize all criticism of itself. Violence has become the defining hallmark of the United States. It is even the basis of U.S. foreign policy. In the 21st century, millions of people have been killed and displaced by American violence against the world. With our public schools and police forces working overtime to teach the children who will comprise the future generations that violence is the solution and submission is the only alternative, expect the United States to be unlivable at home and an even worse danger to the rest of the world. And lamentably, that is the case. There is an alternative, and that is a society based on the sanctity of persons and property, in which violence can only be used for the legitimate necessary defense of the same, and never to uphold authority, the fictitious property exercised by those who incarnate the fiction called the state. Recently, in the Journal of the Foundation for Economic Education, Jeffrey Tucker described his visit to a little town called Atlantic Station, Georgia. A notice posted at the entry to the city declares, "All the common areas of Atlantic Station, including the streets, sidewalks, parks, and alleys, are private property." There is a rules of conduct notice posted in this little enclave within Atlanta, Georgia. As Jeffrey Tucker points out, it's this one line that makes the critical difference. It's why this one square mile in the heart of this great city, meaning Atlanta, has done more to model beauty, prosperity, diversity, and happy living than 50 years of urban renewal and other government programs. Atlantic Station opened 10 years ago as a visionary entrepreneurial venture, the brainchild of the Jacoby Group, headed by Jim Jacoby. Funded mostly with private money, the city helped with tax breaks and some infrastructure funding. It is not a gated community walled off from the public for only the elite. There is no charge to get in. Everything is public access and subject to all the laws governing commercial property. The difference between the public and private city, however, is huge. You can tell when you have entered the space. Whereas many areas of Atlanta struggle, this area in the heart of the city is clean, bright, ebullient, bursting with enterprise and life. I sat outside on the patio of a Mexican food restaurant and watched adults and children playing games and having fun on the green space that serves as a mini park in the middle of this urban experiment in capitalism. There were people from all races, classes, and ages. They listened to the live band and sang along. As I sat there, I was suddenly overwhelmed with the sense of a mini utopia. It's like an idealized scene you see in a commercial for soda or some happy vacation getaway. It was one of the most blissful city scenes I've ever witnessed. It was a typical evening, and it was all taking place in a place that was only 20 years ago a burned-out, low-rent disaster zone, the kind of place people flee. Now, the migration patterns have changed. Atlantic Station is a place where you want to live and work. I was walking along, and a uniformed police officer greeted me good evening. I responded with delight, and we had a nice conversation. She wanted to know if I was enjoying the evening, made a few bar recommendations. We chatted about the weather, and I went on. She was uniformed, yes, and probably armed, but in an unthreatening way. She looked sharp and helpful, as well as official. Then it struck me. The police in this community are privately employed by main stakeholders in the community, which are the merchants, apartment owners, and other service providers. The streets are also private, but public access. For this reason, the police themselves have a deep investment in the well-being of the community and the general happiness of the consumers who shop there. They are employees of the free enterprise system. In particular, Atlantic Station owners contract with Chelsea Brown for experienced service. That, of course, is a private security company. Sometimes, in today's overly militarized environment, it is easy to forget. Policing is a completely legitimate, useful, important profession. They are there to make sure that everyone is keeping the rules and to apprehend the vandals and criminals who break the rules. What makes the difference here is the private nature of the contract that employs them. Just as every other employee in this community, they have a direct stake in the value of the space. They are there to serve customers, just as every merchant in this community does. The more valuable the community, the more valuable their own jobs. They have the incentive to do their job well, which means enhancing the experience of rule keepers while driving out those who do not keep the rules. The point of the rules is not to control people and run their lives. It is to enhance the value of the community for everyone. The first time I entered Atlantic Station was about 18 months ago. I had some sense that something was different about the place, but I hadn't understood that it was entirely private. I stepped out on the sidewalk and I lit up a cigarette. One of these very nice private policemen came up and greeted me and politely asked me to put it out on grounds that this was against the rules. I didn't resent it. In fact, I was delighted to comply. I even thanked him for being so kind. There were no tickets, no yelling, no moments of intimidation. No one is taking your stuff, threatening to arrest you, or even giving you tickets. You have the right of exit. Now think about that for a second. The objective of that police contact was not to punish. It was to explain the nature of the contract that existed within this private space, and if those rules were onerous, to invite the person who was breaking them to leave. You see, punishment isn't the purpose here. The exercise of authority is not the purpose here. The protection of property is the reason why there is a private police force in Atlantic Station, which is a pocket of civilization in a country that is almost entirely rotted with collectivism. Thank you for joining me this week on Freedom Zealot Radio. Please join me online at freedominourtime.blogspot.com. I'll be back with you again in a week, and until then, as always, doom spritto pugno, while I breathe, I fight. Good night, God bless, and may we send the state back to the hell that spawned it.
What do you want to do now, Captain?
The same thing we always do. Fight them until we can't.